Al-Murtada mentions. And as for Shaykh Al-Tusi, there was a statement that was referred to in our previous session, but once again we refer to this statement of the greatest scholar, Shaykh Al-Tusi, that he says that we cannot claim with certainty that Imam Ali Salam is hidden from his friends and lovers, but there is a possibility to be seen by some. Anyone is aware of his own affairs.
Yes.
That is, any single person is better aware of his own affairs.
Right.
So by this literature, it means that they have opened the way for this to have this chance to meet Imam Ali Salam and know that who they are meeting.
Right.
There is a lost viewpoint on visitation of Imam that, inshallah, we shall discuss it in our upcoming session. What is that? The possibility of meeting and visiting Imam Ali Salam and acceptance of the clay.
Right.
So this is a bit, again, controversial.
A controversial thing,
that
yeah.
we shall be discussing, inshallah, in our upcoming sessions.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for adding to our insights so far. May Allah accept from you, and may Allah hasten the reappearance of Imam. Thank you, dear listeners. You are listening to Iran Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa
rahmatullahi. Where is the rising sun? International Media Festival.
Part 1.
Since time immemorial, art has always been a means of expression, to express love, joy, sadness, to document history, and most importantly, to tell a story. Every work of art is a story to be told, and every artist has a unique way of telling their story. In today's program, we talk to a multimedia artist who is one of the leading designers of social justice campaigns in the world. And she'll help us to understand the powerful stories of her one-of-a-kind artwork. This is Sorba, and I'm your host, Hassan Tabakoli. Sahad Khatib is an artist, filmmaker, and designer. She's the daughter of Palestinian massacre survivors. Her artwork attempts to reverse the harm of propaganda through art and philosophy, one painting at a time. She commutes between the United States and Jordan, waiting for colonials to be gone so she can return back to her homeland of Palestine. Sahad Khatib. Welcome to the program.
Ahlan salam.
Good to have you. Well, first of all, to begin with, when did you discover that you want to be an artist?
I really can remember me painting before I was able to speak, and drawing, and finding some kind of satisfaction in that very, very early on. Before, yeah, I mean, it's one of my earliest memories. And when I was in school, art was not taken really seriously in schools that I was in. It was a school near our house, you know, middle class school. The art teacher has studied something in agriculture, and it's just a time for the kids to do something. But my mother early on realized that it's not normal for a kid my age to be drawing that way. And what made it even more interesting for her is that my attention span is really short with everything. But when it comes to painting, I could spend hours and hours. And I grew up in Amman, and there was only one art school in the entire city. And my mother's generation is the first generation of women in her family to get a college education. But she used to tell me stories about hiding her novels inside of her school books so that she can read the novel or draw something without her family asking her to do something useful with her time.
So she was more into verbal art than visual art,
yes,
yeah?
Yes.
Written art.
Storyteller. She's an amazing storyteller too. So in my generation, there are very few kids in my generation whose mother pushed them to do art because she knew she could see something special there, and I think she kind of wanted to fulfill that for the both of us. So she used to drive from one side of the city to the other so that I can go to that art workshop. And I started taking the classes with kids my age. It was a morning program. And the art teacher, I remember told my mom at one point, like, don't bring her to the kids' program, bring her to the adults' program. And no, yani, I think we need to do an upgrade here. And I think, you know, looking back, it seems like a very simple story, like a very simple move. But it really impacted me for the rest of my life. I was a very shy kid, gets nervous at everything, stutters sometimes when they get nervous. And now I'm surrounded by artists like me. And the youngest one of them is 21 years old and I'm in ninth grade. So I would probably be like 15 or something like that. And that social change that came with the art space just was everything. It just flipped things around. And then since then, everybody started calling me in the family, oh, she's the artist. But it didn't necessarily mean something positive in a way, you know, like, oh, she's just wasting her time with this art thing.
That's how they looked at art traditionally.
Right, right. Like, oh, she'll do it in her free time. Not my mother, though, but like a lot of people around us in our family. And when I went to college, when it was time for me to go to college, again, I was one of very few people my generation whose parents begged them to study something that has to do with art instead of go to business school. Because they knew that they were going to pay money for nothing if I go to business school. But I insisted on studying finance. I just like wanted to study finance because there was graphic design and business school. I wanted to go to a different college altogether, but they wouldn't let me go to it. So as a rebellion, always being a rebel, I was like, okay, fine, I'm going to study finance then in this college that you picked for me. And I just couldn't take it. I only took it for one semester. And then one of my friends saw me drawing everyone in my breaks. And he was like, come, I want to show you something. And he took me to the art school in the college that I was in. And it was the only school that taught graphic design. And it was probably the second generation of graphic designers to graduate from all of Jordan at the time.
And that was the door of opportunity.
Exactly. I switched majors immediately the next day. I had a conversation with my family and they were like, thank God, because we really wanted you to succeed. And then as the years went by, when I was in college, I started getting scholarships, which is a thing I've never experienced in my life. I was always an average kid in school, like in the 80s or, you know, but never like in the 90s. So that was a shock for everybody. And that's when we found out that I definitely have something, but now I have to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah.
And years passed by. I participated in a lot of art projects, a lot of art competitions as the years went by. I won a few here and there. People started knowing me, but the place where I grew up in, art was exclusive to a specific kind of people. And I was not born in the city. And my family are what we called Mughtaribin, you know, they worked in the Gulf area, so they were not like, you know, this big name family that is going to take up space just because they're from that family. So I was known for my talent, but there was always a limit. There was always a wall that I would hit. I remember at one point, a couple of people from that facade, the art facade that existed in the city at the time, they told me, you're not as talented as you think you are. And actually, this is something that continued to repeat itself in places where I found out eventually that I was actually being oppressed in this place. I've been limited by that notion that you're not as talented as you think you are.
Was that only based on the fact that you wanted to take part in the arts, or was it, you know, God forbid, gender discrimination? Was that involved in it or not?
I think it's a combination of a lot of things.
Yeah.
When it comes to art, and we'll probably talk more about it in a little bit, when it comes to art, it's very, very important for art to be controlled in whichever, for various reasons. Sometimes it's for really simple reasons, like it's just us five here. We have the funding for those five people, and that's what we're going to do. Everyone else can go away. But sometimes it's for much more serious reasons. It's silencing. It's like trying to avoid telling specific stories. And that's what art is. It's storytelling. And after those few slaps in the face, like you're not as talented as you think you are, and so on and so on, I was really successful in graphic design, in the graphic design world. I had started with a couple of friends on an agency, and then it became the second spending agency in town. We had the biggest accounts, and within 3 years. And then there was a filmmaking workshop in town, which was, we didn't have any film schools in Jordan. I plugged into that and then started
filmmaking.
Into filmmaking, and started making simple films with our friends.
And of course, we'll get to that.
And we'll get to that.
Yeah, but what was your very first work of art? You said illustrations and all. What was that very first work of art that you really, you know, look back at and, you know, really appreciate that was my very first, you know, piece of art that I presented to the world? Do you remember?
I have no idea. I can't remember. And my mom would complain about how many paintings she had to clear out of the house after I left it, because I'm constantly painting.
Yeah.
Until I didn't for 10 years. Until I stopped painting for 10 years.
So there was a gap. And that was because when you wanted to study for finance?
That's when I moved to the United States when I was in my late 20s.
Mm-hmm. Why was there a gap? Because for a person who paints all their life, suddenly a 10-year gap, that's huge.
Right.
Why was that?
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's that you're not as good as you think you are. Not that I thought that I was good, but it was like, it was a preconceived notion. Like, you think you're good, you're not as good as you are. So I stopped thinking that I was good.
They say this imposter syndrome, something like that?
I don't know. I know my reaction to it. I don't know what the intention behind it was, but my reaction to it, no, I'm not going to think that I'm good. I'm just not going to think it.
Mm-hmm.
So that I want to be humble, right?
Yeah.
And then I moved to the United States. And the United States was a very, very rough transition for someone who lived in a very sheltered family, in a very sheltered city, in a very...
From a very small locality to a very big, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you move also, and there's also like, when I talk about the United States, I'm always talking about the capitalist aspect of things.
Yeah.
So in the United States, I'm working as a freelance designer, and I can only rent this specific apartment. And God forbid I would hang anything on the walls, because if I ruin the walls, I'm going to have to pay I don't know how much in
The tenant rules,
insurance,
right?
If one drop of acrylic paint falls on the carpet, I'm going to be destroyed when I leave this apartment. And so you kind of want to protect the things that you have and stop seeing yourself. The things become more important than you.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to paint on big canvases with acrylic colors.
And creating a mess as well.
And creating a big mess.
Yeah.
Because it's part of the...
It is.
It's like playtime.
It is,
right?
It is.
You have rules everywhere, but here you don't have none. And so I stopped for 10 years. And then I went through life. I started organizing... I lived in St. Louis for the first 10 years in my life in the United States. And St. Louis was a very interesting city, because part of it is on the Missouri state and part of it is on the Illinois state. And it's one of the most segregated cities in the world, in the United States for sure. It had all these promises back in the days. It was supposed to be bigger than Chicago, but because of the segregation that exists within, it just froze. And I lived in it for 8 years. And I kept bumping into walls and not understanding, you know, like you come to the US and you're thinking, oh, this is the dream and this is where
freedom,
I'm going.
Freedom, the land of the free and all that, yeah.
And art. And then you go there and you feel like you're constantly being put down, but you don't understand why. And, no. And then Ferguson happens on August 9, 2014. At the time, I was organizing with Palestinian groups, and we had coalitions, and we had had the first BDS win in the United States, where we divested from a water company that was supposed to ruin the water supply in St. Louis. And so there was this young man, his name is Mike Brown. He was 18 years old, and he was shot right in front of his house. And he was left without being covered for 4.5 hours for everyone in the neighborhood to see. And an uprising or protest, whatever you want to call it, just erupted. And black youth reached out to Palestinians in town to start organizing with them. And that's when I understood, oh, I live in a segregated racist system. It took me 8 years to really understand.
To really feel it.
To start understanding. I still don't understand it fully, to be honest.
Yeah.
But to start understanding and, so that's the problem. And so you learn a lot from black women, particularly in these spaces, about who you are as a person, about your presence as a woman, your power as a woman. And because of my organizing there, I got fired from my job at the time. My office, I used to work in an advertising agency, and my office was right across the street from the DOJ. And 2 months later, lo and behold, I was fired from my job. I was the only one cut from my job. And there were so many repercussions based on it, because there was supposed to be a community that is supposed to protect me legally from that, because it was a clear... It was a clear retaliation. The city is so segregated. I'm Palestinian. I'm brown. I'm a woman who's protesting against racism in that city.
The usual case.
Exactly. No. Well, yeah, it was usual, but I was so ignorant. I really didn't know that it was the usual case. So I thought it was like exclusive and I needed to just let things go. And that community support that I was hoping that I would get was non-existent. Something's got put under the rug and people moved on. And I started not feeling very safe in the city. I started getting death threats at the time. So I decided to move to California. And California was a much more stronger shift. California is everything at the same time, right? I worked in Silicon Valley as a designer running brand teams for big tech companies. But I was also going through so much at the time on a personal level. And I just needed to not talk to anyone for 2 hours a day. And I got a very small notepad with just ink, because ink is not going to make a big mess in my apartment. And I got a small notepad because I didn't know if I could paint anymore. It's been 10 years.
My God.
10 years.
Yeah.
And
picking up a pen after 10 years, you know.
Picking up a pen and being by yourself and painting. It's everything that you're afraid of at the same time. And yeah. My decision was not to paint about something specific, just to let go. I'm not going to look at a picture, or I just want to see what I have within. And I started painting roots and roots and roots and roots, and only a little leaf coming out from them on the surface. And I knew after that painting that I could still paint. And then now I have to make a decision. And also, to answer your question, then I realized, and no. You don't paint something and then you say, oh, I'm an artist. You paint something and then you have to choose. I will become an artist. Because being an artist entails a lot of things. And it's a lot of commitment. And it's a lot of self-esteem work that you have to work on. And I had to make a choice to make that decision.
And perhaps that's why you needed a 10-year gap.
Probably.
For that, as you said, you know, that humbleness to come back in.
Right.
And rediscover your, you know, arts and craftsmanship.
And to grow, generally.
Yeah, to grow.
To be able to understand the relationship between art and the story. Because I've been, like, working on film to tell stories, but I thought that was completely different in art. And art is about feeling and what you think and the colors. But for me, at least, it turns out that it was the story part that I was missing. Like, what is the story that I want to tell?
The why in creating art,
exactly.
In producing art. That's the thing you had to reach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then at that point, I decided that I have to, if I choose to become an artist, what is my art going to be about? Mm-hmm. And usually artists, what I've seen artists do is that they have these shows where they get funding in advance and they say, I'm going to make it about autumn or about this,
yeah,
you know,
give a theme, yeah.
But it didn't work for me that way. For me, it was like, I'm just going to paint and figure out over the years what is going to come out.
And how are you going to put it on display?
Yes. And what is the meaning of it, too? Because some of it is like literally from my heart. Like I see things on the paper and I paint them. I trust that they need to be there. And then years later, something happens and an image is replicated. It's exactly what I had painted. It's like me connecting with the ink, with the water, with the stories around me. It's just being honest, like true to yourself at that point.
You know, the dream of every artist is for their artwork to shine, for the artist to be able to communicate to the world through their art, and as you said, tell that story. And of course, you know, every artist wants their art to be unique as well, to stand out, you know, wherever they go. That's my piece of work, that's my piece of work, it stands out. Something very interesting about your work, your artwork is that, you know, you use the colours black and yellow or charcoal or dark grey, something like that, okay? First of all, tell us what's the reason, why? Why these two colours?
There are so many different reasons, Hassan, and every time someone asks me that question, I can come up with another reason.
Really?
But I'm going
What was the main thing that you recurringly answer?
I think there are like two aspects to it. There's the spiritual and there's the material itself. The material itself is easy. Black is, it doesn't consume me with thinking of like, what are the colors that I am feeling right now? And it's how I feel. It's like how I feel on the inside. It's sad.
The colors do represent, you know, a certain theme, a certain idea, a certain, you know, thought. Yeah.
But black can represent everything at the same time. And also ink itself, it was the beginning of how we started accumulating knowledge as humanity, right? Like, this is how it became more available for everybody. And knowledge is the spirit, right? Like, this is how we became spiritual, is by being able to write things down or paint things on paper. And so I kind of wanted to carry on with that ancestral knowledge of what does ink mean to us as as humanity. The gold itself is because, on the spiritual level, is because I see us as gold. I see my people as beautiful people. They are the gold of the earth. No matter what happens around them, they still shine like gold. But from a space perspective too, whenever the light hits the painting, the gold changes with the light. So it stays living, it keeps moving as time goes by. And it's always going to be changing based on lights, and lights is never the same, right? So it's going to always have different meanings to it.
It's very, very interesting. And some of your illustrations, I mean, we were looking through your artwork. It seems, correct me if I'm wrong, okay, it seems that there were already pictures taken before and you painted off of them, yeah?
Yes, because I'm a graphic designer by nature.
Yeah.
And also a filmmaker. And we have this thing where we use a picture that is familiar to people.
A well-known picture, yeah.
Exactly. And you build on it. Mm-hmm. And especially in my study about martyrs, it's like there are specific photos that I want to be remembered. So there, for example, my generation has been really imprinted by the death of Muhammad Durra. I think at that point we realized that even our fathers can't protect us from this enemy, this vicious enemy. And no, our fathers, who are the strongest men we know in the world, still can't protect us. And that does something to you. It makes you want to stand on your own feet and figure out a way to protect your own father as well. But all of the paintings that have been painted about Muhammad, who's left that much of an impact, yeah. They were always, he was always in them scared, at least the ones that I've seen. And I didn't want to leave him scared in my painting. Mm-hmm. So I found one of his pictures and painted him where he was looking down on us like he's looking from the sky.
Oh.
In complete peace, because that's where I wanted him to be.
Indeed.
So that's why I use photography, because it's like something that already exists. We're just building on it. It's kind of like a wish.
Yeah.
It's not, it's a study, you know.
It is.
How would he have been, right? So that's why I use, it's because I'm a graphic designer and because I want to build on that story, pre-existing story.
Well, thank you, Sahad.
Of course. Thank you.
And we thank our guest, Sahad Khatib from Jordan, for taking part in this program. Until another program, from me, Hassan Tavakoli, and the rest of the team, is goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Billionaire businessman and Donald Trump supporter Elon Musk has been sued over his $1 million a day election giveaway. The complaint alleges that Elon Musk's America PAC deceived voters by falsely claiming prize winners would be chosen at random. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Billionaire businessman and Donald Trump supporter Elon Musk was sued in a proposed class action lawsuit on Tuesday, 5th of November, by registered voters who signed his petition to support the Constitution for a chance to win his $1 million a day giveaway, and now claim it was all a fraud. The complaint, filed by the Arizona resident Jacqueline McCafferty in a federal court of law, said Elon Musk and his America PAC organization falsely induced voters to sign a petition by claiming they would choose winners by chance. In fact, members of the PAC selected the winners, the suit alleges. Musk's own attorney said in court that the sweepstakes results were not random. They disclosed that the winners were chosen to be spokespeople for the group. The $1 million recipients are not chosen by chance, Chris Gober, a lawyer for Elon Musk, said during a hearing in Pennsylvania. Chris Gober added, "We know exactly who will be announced as the $1 million recipient today and tomorrow." Elon Musk, meanwhile, said at a campaign rally that his PAC would be awarding $1 million randomly to people who have signed the petition. Jacqueline McCafferty also said the defendants had profited from the giveaway by driving traffic and attention to Elon Musk's ex-social media platform and by collecting personal information such as her name, address and phone number that they could sell. A lawyer for Elon Musk and lawyers for Jacqueline McCafferty did not immediately respond to requests for comment. McCafferty sued a day after a Philadelphia judge denied a request by that city's district attorney, Larry Krasner, to end the giveaway, which Krasner called an illegal lottery. That ruling was largely symbolic because Elon Musk has no plans to give out more money following the US presidential election. The world's richest person opened the giveaway to voters in seven battleground states who signed a petition to support free speech and gun rights. Tuesday, 5th of November's lawsuit seeks at least $5 million in damages for everyone who signed the petition. Elon Musk has supported Donald Trump in the presidential race against Kamala Harris and given upwards of $100 million via the America PAC to Trump's campaign. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. Elon Musk was sued in a proposed class action lawsuit on Tuesday, 5th of November, by registered voters who signed his petition to support the Constitution for a chance to win his $1 million a day giveaway and now claim it was all a fraud. The complaint filed by Arizona resident Jacqueline McCafferty in the Austin, Texas Federal Court of Law said Elon Musk and his America PAC organization falsely induced voters to sign by claiming they would choose winners randomly, though they were predetermined. She also said the defendants profited from the giveaway by driving traffic and attention to Elon Musk's ex-social media platform and by collecting personal information such as her name, her address and phone number that they could sell. A lawyer for Elon Musk and lawyers for Jacqueline McCafferty did not immediately respond for requests for comment. Jacqueline McCafferty sued one day after a Philadelphia judge denied a request by the city's district attorney, Larry Krasner, to end the giveaway, which Krasner called an illegal lottery. That ruling was largely symbolic, though, because Elon Musk has no intention of giving out more money following the US presidential election on 5th of November. The world's richest person opened a giveaway to voters in seven battleground states who signed a petition to support free speech and gun rights. Tuesday's lawsuit seeks at least $5 million worth of damages for everyone who signed Elon Musk's petition. Musk is a Texas resident and his electric car company Tesla is based in Austin, Texas. He has supported Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump in the presidential race against Democrat Vice President Kamala Harris. The case is Jacqueline McCafferty versus Elon Musk et al. At U.S. District Court, Western District of Texas.
questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Iran Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. In this program, we answer your curious questions and we discuss the topics regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Our answers are rooted in the Holy Book of Quran and the Hadith of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and also the narrations of Imams. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon them. Well, we have talked a lot about the lives of the martyrs, and we also derived lessons with Brother Liaquat in the beginning episodes from the lives of Ahlul Bayt. And today, Brother Liaquat, first of all, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome again.
Thank you, sister.
And today I would want you to give us a concluding session on whatever we learned from the lives of Shuhada, what we learned from the lives of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim assalam. In different aspects of our lives, when it comes to upbringing, when it comes to teenagers.
Perfect. So, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. So, from the lives of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim aslam, from the lives of Shuhada, there are, like, I would say, we can take 10 beautiful points in our lives, which we have to teach our teenagers. If they are teens, they have to learn from the lives of Ahlul Bayt. These 10 points for sure, definitely. Number one is honesty, being honest.
Right.
Is something which we learn from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasallatu wasalam, and also the lives of Shuhada. Like, they were very honest in their life, even in difficult situations. And the teenagers can learn the value of honesty, like in their relationships and interactions, being honest in the relationship with their parents, like with their brother or sister. Yeah. The second lesson, what we learn from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam and the Shuhada, for teenagers especially, is respect for parents.
Indeed.
The Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, particularly Imam Ali alayhi wasalam and Sayyidah Fatima salamu alayha, demonstrated deep respect and love for their parents.
Right.
This is extremely seen in their lives.
Behavior.
Okay? Yeah, exactly. Like Sayyidah Fatima with regards to Rasulullah, and Amirul Mu'minin with regards to Hazrat Abu Talib alayhi salam,
right,
and Sayyidah Fatima bint Asad salam,
right,
alayha. This teaches, and they were teens.
Right.
You see, Imam Ali was a teenager then, and Sayyidah Fatima salamu alayha
was a
from their lives.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So this teaches the teenagers importance of honoring and
parents,
valuing the family relationships, like how,
right,
how important it is to give value, to give,
right,
weight to the parents, example.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So the second, the third lesson I would say is compassion and kindness, being kind. The Ahlul Bayt alayhi muslim were known for their compassion towards others, including those who oppressed them. You see, it's like it was. There are a lot of against incidents over here to cover, anyways.
Right.
And they emphasized treating everyone with kindness, regardless of the differences. The Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. I would say the teenagers can learn the importance of empathy and helping those in need over here,
right,
and also from the lives of Shuhada. We,
right,
see a lot, like being kind to one,
right,
another.
Right, and there have been all Imams that have been generous. There have been all Imams that have been giving charity throughout their life. But the extreme amount of generosity was seen in the life of Imam Hassan alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
who gave away,
mm-hmm,
his entire thing, like more than twice.
Yeah. More than twice, he gave away whatever he had.
And that's really hard. That's really a difficult job.
Definitely. It is indeed definitely hard. Actually, there was my kind of research upon a topic where I was doing research on the the work of the prophets and the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wassalatu wassalam, like what they used to do in order to survive, have their livelihood.
Make their daily living.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly. Meet their daily needs. Yeah.
Right.
So it was, of course, right now it's off topic. So maybe some other day. But it's a very interesting topic. Like, it's not that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam used to sit in A'udhu Billah and they used to gather money and they used to spend it. No, they used to work. They used to
very,
work.
Very hard.
Mm-hmm, yeah, in order to meet their daily needs. And
right.
Of course, they would earn and
yes.
They would also do tabligh as well.
Right. We'll derive more beautiful lessons from their lives. So let's take a short break here. Dear listeners, we'll be back in a while.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor, Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
So, welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We have been talking about the conclusion of our episodes that we have learned from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, what we learned from the lives of Shuhada. And we have been talking about three lessons. We said we learn honesty, we learn respect for parents, and we learn compassion, being compassionate. So yes, Brother Liaquat, what more lessons do we have?
Yeah, so example, one of the lessons, I would say point number four, is the importance of knowledge for the teenagers.
Indeed.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam famously valued knowledge and education. You see? And of course, there were other imams as well. Like example, Imam Baqir alayhi salatu wasalam, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam.
However, Babul Ilm is...
Oh, goodness.
Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Exactly. So... Ana Madinatul Ilm wa Aliyun Babaha, and who wants to enter the city
gate
of
knowledge. City of knowledge.
The city of knowledge to enter.
The gate is Ali.
So indeed, it is Amirul Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wassalam. Of course, you know, Imam Ali, he encouraged seeking knowledge as a lifelong pursuit. It's not like from childhood until master's or bachelor's or PhD, something like that. No, it's a lesson for everyone.
Right.
Like in his teenage, in his youth, in his adulthood, Imam Ali alayhi salam was on this path. Like he would stand staunch and he would insist on gaining knowledge, you see.
Right.
Anyways, there were stories and there are stories a lot. Of course, a few of them were also told in the studio as well. Anyways, so this lesson encourages the teenagers to prioritize their education and intellectual growth, I would say.
Right.
Even the shuhada, like the shaheed which we were speaking, like he would have this thing as a penalty to study more and gain more knowledge, you see. And of course, it's very important for the educators and the parents, the teachers, to show the importance of knowledge. And there are a number of ahadiths showing the importance of knowledge, more important than wealth.
Right.
Like wealth can be taken away, but knowledge cannot be taken. Yeah. So anyways. So
and
this
even
is,
if you spend money, it gets less.
In fact, that's with regards to knowledge. But with regards to knowledge, example, even after I step out of the studio, I still recall what I just told, you see?
Right.
Like I was sharing it with you.
It increases.
Exactly. Yeah. It's actually, it increases and it has a lot of barakah as well. When I would say the teens.
In fact, there is a hadith that says that zakat of knowledge is to share it.
Perfect. Excellent. Actually, I was coming to this point.
Right.
I would let's say the teens, to share your knowledge.
Right.
It's not just to gain the knowledge. Importance of knowledge is not just by gaining, but also sharing. Through sharing. Exactly. Right. Through this hadith again, just which you have quoted from the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. Okay, so by sharing, example, by telling what you know, increases it. And
right.
It has barakah, and it has a lot deeper effect with a bigger magnitude
right.
on the person himself or herself. If
right.
the person tells it to other people, like about the knowledge, yeah.
Right. Let's explore more, but let's take a short break here and we'll be back in a while.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Regarding the saying of Allah the Exalted, U anfusakum wa ahlikum nara, save yourselves and your family from a fire. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, teach yourselves and your family righteousness.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Brother Liaquat is with me, and we are giving a concluding session on what we learned from the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and the lives of Shuhada. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I was saying honesty, respect for parents, compassion and kindness, the importance of knowledge. Number 5 is courage in adversity.
Wow.
This is very important, yeah?
Really?
For teenagers. So if they want to follow the path of Ahlul Bayt and the Shuhada, 10 lessons can be derived, I would say.
Right.
Amongst them is the fifth lesson is courage in adversity. The lives of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wassalam, often involved challenges
right.
and we see and also persecution, and they're facing in
and
difficulties
there was adversity
teachers.
To the extent that where one could lose entire hope, entire mm-hmm. patience mm-hmm. and everything, in fact sometimes maybe faith
mm-hmm. yeah exactly. We see the Ahlul Bayt over here like facing adversity
with courage,
with a lot of courage, with a
patience.
Lot of patience. This teaches the teenagers the importance of standing up for their values, for their beliefs, even when it is difficult. It shouldn't be like, oh, you know what, I'm facing with this difficulty, so I'm going to lose faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, example,
right,
okay?
Right.
Nauzubillah. Okay, anyways, so courage in adversity, this is another lesson. And justice and equality, number 6, I would say, is justice and equality. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam fought for justice and the rights of the oppressed, and they exemplified the importance of standing up for what is right, advocating for social justice and understanding for the rights of others, example. And the shuhada as well, a few shuhada would not eat food because it would not reach other people. So
right.
it would, like, they would take very small quantity from the big vessel of food.
Right.
They would take very little quantity. When it was asked to them, like, why are you taking very little quantity? They used to say, this
sharing
is the haq
caring.
Of other people.
Right,
yeah, exactly. So it's just and it's equality over here,
right.
which they were showing, mashallah. And number 7 was, this was number 6. Number 7 is unity and brotherhood.
Right.
The lessons, what we can take from Ahlul Bayt. The Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salam, again, they preached unity amongst the Muslim community. This is extremely shown throughout the lives of the imams.
But in our teenagers salam. Today, what is being mostly done in the advertisement sessions, there's a lot of racism. There's a lot of racism. There's a lot of this name-calling thing. There's a lot of this. I won't say that there's some brotherhood kind of thing. There's a division of sects. There's this focus on the differences. And there's no coming to the common points.
Mm-hmm.
But it's suggesting
mm-hmm.
us
mm-hmm.
to come on the common points,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
avoid the differences, and show the unity and brotherhood.
Indeed, indeed. This is a very like big lesson or vital lesson for teenagers about the importance of cooperation, the teamwork, and also building stronger
right.
relationships. Yeah, like if there's unity and there's brotherhood, a lot of teamwork can be done.
Right.
You see? And this was number 7. And number 8 was balancing time. A lesson what we can derive from the lives of Ahlul Bayt. The Imams, alayhim as-salam, balance their spiritual duties with their day-to-day responsibilities. Okay?
Right.
And the teenagers can, of course, learn the importance of time management.
Right.
Prioritizing their studies, social lives, and also spiritual growth from the lives of Ahlul Bayt and also from the lives of Shuhada
right.
as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's keep the other lessons for the upcoming sessions, inshallah. Thank mm-hmm. you so much for being with us. Thank you so much to Thank your you listeners. Mr. You were listening to Iran Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's leader hails Lebanon's Hezbollah movement for its continued resistance against Israel, saying those who think the group has weakened are delusional. The UN says the Palestinians held under Israel's near total brutal siege in northern Gaza are starving while the world watches. And Iran reacts to the victory of Donald Trump in the U.S. presidential race, saying elections are a chance for Washington to reassess its past wrong policies. Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to World News. In our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has hailed Lebanon's Hezbollah movement for its continued resistance against Israel. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, despite the martyrdom of top Hezbollah leaders, enemy has not been capable of defeating it. Ayatollah Khamenei said the region and world one day witnessed the defeat of the Israeli entity by the hands of these fighters. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader said Israel's war on Gaza is aimed at eradicating the Hamas resistance movement. He said despite the massacre of tens of thousands of people and martyrdom of a group's leaders, Israel has not achieved its goal. Ayatollah Khamenei said that Hamas is still fighting, and this means a defeat of Israel. Israel presses ahead with its aggression against Lebanon, targeting a car in the east of the capital, Beirut, in one of the latest strikes. Drone strike hit the car on a key road linking Beirut with Beqa Plain in eastern Syria. Airstrike had reportedly left casualties. In the Beqa Valley, Israel's overnight air raid demolished several homes in the village of Al Ain. Lebanon's health ministry said the 40 people have been killed and dozens more wounded in the eastern Beqa Valley and Baalbek since Wednesday. At least 3,050 Lebanese now have been killed in Israeli strikes since October last year. And in one of the Israeli strikes on Lebanon, a residential building was targeted in the Bajra town of the south of Beirut. 20 civilians, most of them children, were killed, and now their neighbors are grieving the loss.
All of a sudden, I felt this huge pressure, and then boom, everything exploded. My son was telling me to read the Quran before we die. I picked him up and brought him to the civil defense and the intelligence forces here. I went back and got my wife and left through back of the building. God have mercy on them. They all died. They had some 10 children that used to play here. They were all children and women.
This strike hit out of nowhere. From where or how, we have no idea. All we saw was destruction. The Red Cross and the civil defense came, but it was all children. There is nothing here. There is no military presence in the neighborhood. Nothing. This is what Israel does. Nowhere is safe. It wants to plant fear among the people, to say that you are not safe, no matter where you are.